courts have built up to be completely unrepayable. The rich-poor division has increased, and the type of jobs coming into existence due to the technological shift are now temporary and part-time.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Director of Communications, Lee Kane, has quit, and now his top advisor, Dominic Cummings, has left as well. Some say this will make for smoother Brexit talks, due to resume this week before an EU summit on Thursday. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The British Labour Party has found itself entangled in yet another racism crisis after a new report found huge levels of Islamophobia within the party. The report, commissioned by the newly formed Labour Muslim Network, suggests that current party leader Sir Keir Starmer has greatly lost the trust of his party's Muslim members. Just some of the damning results claim that
more than one in four Muslim members and supporters have experienced Islamophobia within party ranks. 59% say they do not feel well represented by the leadership. 55% claim they don't even trust the leadership to tackle Islamophobia effectively. While 46% feel the party doesn't represent the community effectively.
In response to the report, I reached out to British Muslims who have already decided to quit the party to ask why they felt they had to leave.
And from the people I've met, the councillors I've experienced, the talking I've had, conversations, prior to even Keir Starmer's appointment, there was a problem within the Labour Party. Once he came into his position, it just reinforced everything that we were already saying that is happening and existing. And this was the reason for my exodus and the large exodus by my community.
The report, which interviewed hundreds of British Muslim members, added that some key policy issues create hurt amongst Muslims, including its stance on Israeli crimes in Palestine and Starmer's U-turn on Labour's Kashmir policy earlier this year.
Leave the Labour Party, cut off your cards, and let your friends and family know that this is what's happening, and Keir Starmer shouldn't be able to silently still get our vote and then still implement these ways. Labour is a failed system. Labour is a crumbling system, and Labour is not something that will represent us as British Muslims who live in the UK now. You know, it's just not. And Keir Starmer, I would sincerely hope that you would consider your position on the Kashmir issue.
Before Starmer took over, the party was rocked by the anti-Semitism crisis for many years. Some even argue it's what brought down the previous leadership. But the question is, will the response be the same to this blatant crisis of Islamophobia within the party? Many are arguing not. Robert Carter, London.
Once again, the violent clashes. The police tear gassed protesters to disperse them in Pakistan's garrison city of Rawalpindi near capital Islamabad. Nonetheless, a massive crowd emerged on the streets despite chilly weather conditions. At the heart of an intense public anger is the display of a blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet of the Islam by the French government on state-run buildings last month. Since then, there has been no let-up to the protest like this in Pakistan. The frequent publications, newspapers, and public display of anti-Islamic blasphemous cartoons have ignited an unprecedented scale of public resentment against France and its citizens in Pakistan. Protesters vowed to avenge the blasphemers of the Prophet of the Islam.
The honor of our Prophet is being insulted by the President of France. We demand the government official to kick out the ambassador of France right now from the Pakistan. Otherwise, these all people will protest. We will march in millions towards the embassy of France. We will march in millions, inshallah.
Being here in this weather, in this condition, against the government of France, against the officials, who they are not kicking the France ambassador from the Pakistan, why we are here to protect our respect of our holy prophet Muhammad Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. No one can stop us to protect the our own religion, over the respect of our holy prophet Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
Pakistan's mainstream media largely opted to black out the coverage of this protest, allegedly under pressure to contain the agitation on this most sensitive issue. The organizers complain that their large number of protesters were arrested to prevent them to participate in the gathering. The government suspended all cell phone services and blocked all major highways to prevent the entry of angry protesters in the capital city. The extraordinary security measures have been undertaken to avert the repetition of violent clashes happened not far from French embassy in Islamabad in early this month. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
It seems the growing number of coronavirus infections and death has not yet sounded the alarm in Turkey's government offices to impose another lockdown in the country. The reluctance comes amid reports that the flow of tourists is still going strong in Turkey amid the pandemic, especially in its largest city of Istanbul, which has not only the highest number of tourists but also the highest number of coronavirus infections and death. The city counts for about 40% of confirmed infected cases in Turkey. This number forced the mayor of Istanbul, Ekrem İmamoğlu, to call on the government to impose a total lockdown in the city for at least 2 to 3 weeks. However, his call was rejected.
When we look at the current data, it is obvious that a lockdown is absolutely necessary. I have shared this issue with all the authorities and people of Istanbul. I think a 2 to 3 week lockdown is necessary. This is highly advised by our scientists and experts.
Many believe that the government's decision is deeply rooted in its economic concerns. The government officials maintain that the closure of restaurants and public places at 10 p.m., along with social distancing and wearing masks, is enough to contain the virus.
The second wave of the coronavirus is spreading all over the world, and the situation is getting worse. Many governments may consider lockdown as an effective way to cope with the pandemic, but lockdown has its own consequences. Many people will lose their jobs, and it seems the Turkish government is now mainly concerned with the economic aspects of the lockdown.
Turkey's Cultural and Tourism Ministry announced last week that since the end of the last lockdown several months ago, the country has had 9.46 million visitors from various countries, including European ones, where the pandemic has hit the most. Those arriving to Turkey are not even being tested, which makes the spread of the virus even easier. Many here say Turkish government is favoring economy over public health. Now, the main question is how far the government may remain reluctant to meet the growing demands for lockdown as the country's coronavirus infections and death are getting out of control. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
The Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela has strongly rejected a round of one-year-long sanctions fired by the European Union, which challenges the legitimacy of the upcoming legislative elections in the Latin American nation. Nicolas Maduro made the remarks after the EU's European Council condemned a decision by the Supreme Court of Venezuela to reshuffle the composition of the country's National Electoral Council. Maduro said the move by the European body is influenced by the regime change policy of the United States, which refuses to recognize Maduro's presidency and the country's legal institutions. The Venezuelan head of state said the elections will take place despite the economic sanctions because they follow the rule of the national constitution. Officials totally back Maduro's statement.
The EU sanctions are a violation of international law, and therefore we absolutely repudiate them. From a different perspective, many opposition members justify the EU policy.
From a different perspective, many opposition members justify the EU policy. However, experts say the EU sanctions are unfounded and influenced by Washington.
The EU is mistaken in politically following the U.S. meddlesome policy. The truth is, most political parties are running in these legislative elections.
Despite the aggression by the EU, The government of Venezuela says Maduro will go on as the country's president, and parliamentary elections will be held this year because Venezuela is a free country and it won't be brought to its knees by foreign sanctions. Jesus Silva Caracas.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq. Greetings be upon them. And which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master and Prophet, Abul Qasim al-Mustafa, Muhammad, and upon his pure, immaculate, chosen, and infallible household, especially the one remaining with Allah on earth. I wish to congratulate all viewers, all the people of Iran, and the entire great Islamic Ummah on the auspicious birthday anniversary of the Holy Prophet and the Great Messenger, God's greetings be upon him and his household, and the birthday anniversary of Hadhrat Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace and greetings be upon him. This is a great Eid. This holy birthday prepared the ground for the Holy Prophet's Bi'tha, and his Bi'tha has been the greatest historic event for humanity from the beginning to the end. I hope that this Eid will be a joyous occasion for our dear people, the dear Iranian nation, all Muslim nations, and the great Islamic Ummah. I hope that it will have many blessings for the human community, God willing.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Today, there are three occasions. One is this auspicious and great birthday anniversary, that of the Holy Prophet and his holy progeny, Hadhrat Sadiq, peace and greetings be upon him. Another is Unity Week, which is a very important occasion. And the last is the 13th of Aban, which is the day of fighting against arrogance. There are many ayahs in the Holy Quran about the Holy Prophet, God's greetings be upon him and his household. Some of these ayahs clearly manifest humanity's condition in the present time. When one reads these ayahs, one feels as if they had been sent down for today's humanity. One ayah is from Holy Surah Al-Bara'ah. Now has come unto you a messenger from among yourselves. It grieves him that you should perish. Ardently anxious is he over you. To the believers, he is most kind and merciful. The Holy Quran, chapter 9, verse 128. The first two sentences of the ayah are related to the entire humanity. There is another ayah which says, O men, I am sent unto you all as the messenger of Allah. The Holy Quran, chapter 7, verse 158. The entire humanity is addressed by the Holy Prophet in this ayah. These two sentences are very important.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we're currently cruising over Iranian skies.
شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The all-knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kavit Havli. When it comes to the U.S. troop withdrawal, well, it is never a complete withdrawal. From the recent announcements of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and Iraq to their previous withdrawal announcements, there always appears to be, well, a small contingent that is left over. But why? Like in the case of Iraq, which not only MPs, but many Iraqis actually want the U.S. to withdraw its troops from the country completely. U.S. troop withdrawal is the subject of this edition of the debate. Let me introduce our guests. We have James Dutras, who's a former U.S. Senate foreign policy analyst, joining us from Washington, D.C. We also have Michael Springman, who's an author and former diplomat, also joining us from Washington, D.C. James Dutras, let me first start with you. The Pentagon has said that the U.S. will slash troop levels in Afghanistan and in Iraq to the lowest levels in nearly 20 years of war after President Donald Trump pledged to end the conflicts abroad. Your reaction to that, and why it is that they are going to still, the U.S. is still going to leave a small contingent of troops in the countries, both countries?
Well, as we know, President Trump has suggested many times he wants to get American troops out of Afghanistan, Iraq, and also Syria. As far as I know, we haven't heard anything about Syria in the latest announcements. And we know that he's been met every step of the way with a great deal of opposition from the bipartisan establishment. And even these reductions, not even a complete withdrawal, as you say, have been met almost with hysteria by the establishment. So we'll see if he's even able to manage to do that. But you're right. I think he's probably doing about as much as he thinks he can do toward a complete withdrawal. And even that, even these reductions, I think are still a big fat question mark, assuming that he's going to be leaving office in January. Can he even get that done between now and then? So far, his track record has not been good.
Well, we know that there are Afghan peace talks that are going on, Michael Springman, if you want to call them any type of peace talks that are making any type of progress. I'd like to get your reaction on what the Taliban spokesman has said. Quote, it is a good step, the announcement of the troop withdrawal, and it's in the interest of the people of both countries that the sooner the foreign forces leave, the more the war will be prevented. If that's the case, and if you agree with him, first of all, then why hasn't the U.S. And other foreign forces left Afghanistan at this point?
Well, I agree with the Taliban spokesman. The Taliban's position all along has been to get foreign forces out of their country. Yet the Americans and the Europeans, the NATO, the defensive alliance has somehow turned into an offensive one, are still there, and there are about 7,000 of them, and there is a question as to any of them will be leaving or not. You've got the excuses being given by the so-called foreign policy establishment, the people who've supported wars and invasions and so forth over the years, as being horrified that, oh, we won't be able to control terrorism. We have to have people there to deal with these people. Well, I think the whole point of the opposition to the American occupation of the various countries in the region is terrorism. People are fighting for their homeland and fighting to get the imperial stormtroopers out of their country and send them back home. Nothing is said at all about the roughly 100,000 other U.S. servicemen in the area, nor the 300,000 or more in Europe, nor the 50-odd thousand in Japan. They focus on a couple of countries, cutting the forces by 2,500 in Afghanistan and maybe 500 in Iraq, and not a word about the 1,000 or so, if not more, helping steal the oil from the Syrian government. So it's a whole shell game, I guess you want to call it. Hide the peanut. What do you want to do with this stuff? Not one word is said about the $1 billion worth of American military equipment stored in Israel, nor how many servicemen are actually serving in Israel at the present time. So it's focusing on a small item at the expense of a large item. It's ignoring the elephant in the room, so to speak.
The opposition has come on this, James Jatras. Let's focus on it's coming about the withdrawal, U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. Germany has stated, we are particularly concerned over what the U.S. announcement could mean for the continuation of peace talks in that country. This comes from the German foreign minister. But when you take a look at the opposition in the case of Afghanistan, hasn't the U.S. had enough time in that country? 19 years they have spent there, along with foreign forces.
Well, yes, 19 years, and we've been in Korea for how many decades, and in Japan and Germany for how many decades? I think the rule here is that whatever the excuse is, that they come up with an ad hoc basis, whether it's stopping terrorism. Of course, as we know, in many countries like Syria, we've been supporting the terrorists, like we did in Libya, whether it's to help women's rights or to prevent instability, or whether it's to counter the Russians or the Chinese or keep an eye on Pakistan and their nuclear weapons. All these excuses are ad hoc excuses toward one end, and that is no place that American boots have ever been on the ground will they ever be withdrawn. And that seems to be the consensus of the American bipartisan establishment, is that we are not in these forever wars because we are trying to achieve some objectives. Those objectives keep changing. The goalposts keep changing. What is the constant is that we don't ever want these forces to be withdrawn, because especially in a place like Afghanistan, which is probably one of the hardest places to get American forces into as a you might say, a strategic footprint in Central Asia. Once we're out, maybe it's not so easy to get back in. So the establishment never wants to relinquish that foothold, and they'll just keep up coming up with as many excuses as they need to for another 19 years, another 19 years, another 19 years.
Okay, last question about Afghanistan at this point, I think, Michael Springman, and we'll go on to another country. And this particular expose was revealed by the Washington Post back in the year 2019 that revealed that senior U.S. officials failed to tell the truth about the war throughout the 19-year campaign, making rosy pronouncements that they knew were false and hiding unmistakable evidence that the war was unwinnable. And it was known for years that this was the case. So with this, and they had, confessions from senior military officials within this revelation that the Washington Post made in that year. Given that fact and that track record, how is it that the U.S. then wants to convince Americans that it should continue and prolong these wars?
Well, it goes back to Vietnam. The Americans were lying about what was happening there, that the war can be won next week, we just have more men and so forth. They ignored the actual facts on the ground there. But they want to convince the Americans that American soldiers are needed in Afghanistan and elsewhere, simply because if the American people start to think about how much money and how many lives are being wasted, not only American ones, but God knows how many Afghan ones, the Americans might think twice about permitting their government to engage in foreign escapades at the expense of vast sums of money, vast quantities of life, and a totally useless action that is not winnable and should not be winnable in the first place. The American soldiers should never have been there to begin with 20 years ago.
Now let's move on to Iraq. James Dutross, you have Iraq and also Afghanistan, in which they have said, for example, Afghanistan's national security spokesperson, that the forces there are already, the Afghan security and defense forces are already conducting 96% of the operations independently in that country to defend it against the enemies. If you have the Afghan National Security Forces saying that, and in Iraq also, you have the Iraqi army that says that they can take care of, for example, the fight against terrorism, against the Daesh terrorists, then why is the U.S. insisting on staying on?
As I say, this is part of simply a pattern of the American establishment. We never want to leave any place we've ever been in. And one of the ironies, of course, is we keep saying we're there to bring democracy to these countries. We overthrew Saddam Hussein to bring democracy to Iraq, and now that they have something like a democracy and a parliament that says they want us out, well, that doesn't count, though. That's not the kind of democracy we're talking about. Look, I don't know what else to say on this front. It's window dressing, that the goal is global domination. These are footholds where we can strategically try to box in powers we don't like. Obviously, if you look at both Iraq and Afghanistan, what's right in between them? Iran. And so this is part of our strategic boxing in Iran and also putting pressure on Russia, China, the Belt and Road Initiative, and so forth. And we'll come up with any excuse we want to. And, of course, our stated goals like democracy are simply window dressing.
So when it comes to the reasons, Michael Springman, of the U.S. staying, obviously for them to have personnel on the ground in their bases is one of those reasons. However, we're seeing in the case of Iraq, Afghanistan also, but in the case of Iraq, that things have somewhat changed since the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and the response that Iran gave to the U.S. After that assassination. Do you think in that respect, then the U.S. decided at this point for the further decrease of their troops in that country down to, they say 2,500, but it could be as low as 500. It all depends, again, how you look at it, what source you have.
Well, from what I've seen, they're talking only about removing 500 servicemen from Iraq, and supposedly they want to keep them there to fight terrorists. And as Professor Edmund Gharib, the Washington, D.C. expert on the region, said, and I quoted my book, Thesis for Al-Qaeda, there was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq until the American invasion. So I think it's another species example of why the Americans justify continuing to occupy a country with which we are not at war. Again, it's a continuation of this building a ring of fire around Iran that will not be removed. You've got bases stretching all the way around the country, through the Gulf and up into Afghanistan, and westward to Jordan and so forth. So I think that it's basically for American political purposes to control the region, American economic purposes. You have soldiers overseas, you need to equip them, you need to pay them, you need to send them weapons, you need to send them ammunition, and it's jobs for the boys back in the United States amongst the big defense contractors. So everybody benefits except the people who are being occupied.
Okay, somewhat of this focus is obviously, James Dutras, on the U.S. military and its personnel. We know that China is ranking very high on the list of the U.S. in terms of the way that it's dealing with it in the South China Sea, for example, crisis. What is your take on the pivot that started when Obama was in power in the year 2014 towards China and to where it has escalated now? Are we looking at troop deployment into that area on a faster scale, and yet having some troop drawdowns in places as they have announced, Afghanistan and Iraq?
Well, I'm not sure about the second part, because as I said, I'm skeptical if these drawdowns will occur. I would not necessarily make that a one-to-one. We withdraw from the Middle East and put them against China. I think probably they will stay in the Middle East, and then they will also be deployed against China, that we will simply continue to crank up the war machine against Iran, against China, against Russia, maybe against Venezuela, who knows. And I think that's irrespective of whether Trump somehow manages to hang on to office or whether Biden and his team of warmongers come in. There's been some speculation that maybe because Biden is compromised by his son's relationship, business relationship with the Chinese, that he would go easy on them. Frankly, I think that we'll probably see stepped up anti-China steps in rhetoric and deployments in the South China Sea, the Taiwan Strait, and so forth. And to the extent that Biden feels that he is vulnerable politically on that front, he'll probably do the same thing that Trump did on the accusations that he was a puppet of Vladimir Putin. Nobody's been tougher on the Russians than I've been. And I'm sure that my guess is that Biden will try to tout how tough he is on the Chinese to show that he has no such compromises that he has to be worried about. I don't think it's an either-or proposition, though, that we will continue a full-court press against perceived enemies in many regions of the world.
So our guest, James Dutras, called it the Biden warmonger team. Michael Springman, tell us why he would say that and how his approach would be towards having troops, for example, in the West Asia region, like in Iraq and in Afghanistan.
Well, from what I've seen in various articles written by McGovern and Phil Giraldi, both with the CIA, formerly with the CIA, and another fellow whose name I can't recall at the moment, Biden apparently is bringing in the Obama neocon team. You've got Samantha Power being suggested as Secretary of State, Michelle Flournoy as Secretary of Defense, sending Hillary Clinton to the United Nations as ambassador there, along with Susan Rice, and other people who Victoria Nuland, the architect of the disaster in the Ukraine, to bring back the old crowd, and they're going to again give the impression that, oh yes, we're for peace and truth, justice, and what used to be the American way, and it's going to be more of the same. It will be no difference between Trump and Obama and Biden and Clinton and the Bush crime syndicate. And of course, they're going to continue Obama's pivot to the Far East to try and contain China, no matter what it costs, no matter if it sparks a conflict with these American incursions into Chinese territorial waters and into the sprinkle of islands in Southeast Asia that are claimed by four or five or six different countries. So I see nothing but trouble ahead.
What about Syria, James Dutras? We know that Trump, when he did a troop drawdown there, he got lots of flack for his decision, even to this day. The country said no, it was the wrong move by the U.S. And it almost seemed like, in response, he left a small contingent to guard those oil fields, which we now know that is being used, the revenues is being used, and not to the Syrian government, obviously. What's going to be the approach there from here on? And of course, given that Trump may end up leaving, We still don't know. As the media reports, he could be on his way out with the new president-elect coming in.
That's right. Well, to start with, let's remember, I think maybe Trump, who's probably not the most discerning person in the world regarding his subordinates, was maybe conned on this silly notion of we have to stay there to guard Syria's oil. But in fact, we know that James Jeffrey, the former envoy for Syria, has openly admitted that they lied to the president about how many troops were really in Syria and that they were hiding the numbers from him so that our presence there was actually much bigger than the president thought it was. I think Syria, in all likelihood, if the Biden team comes in, will suddenly flare up again. Because remember, these are the people who back under the Obama administration, after their great success in Libya with regime change there, they became the biggest supporters of al-Qaeda and its offshoots in Syria to overthrow the legitimate government of Syria under Bashar al-Assad. And I think they will go back to that script, that since Trump has not managed to get us out of the Syria business, there's still that toehold there, and these people will come back with a vengeance to try to complete the work that they started in 2011 to keep that war going, to flare it up again, start deploying again these terrorist assets, and double down on regime change in Syria. So that's what I think that's a very predictable spot we can watch blow up once these people come back into their own.
Michael Springman, so therefore that may give perhaps some truth to how the U.S. uses, for example, Iraq to funnel troops into Syria for operations there. But do you agree with that assessment made there by James Dutras in terms of how Syria may become front and center again for the possibly incoming administration of Joe Biden?
Yes, I do. And I would add that it would be another chance for the Biden administration that in fact comes in to look to attack Iran, because Iran has been providing advisors and supplies to the legitimate Syrian government forces and assisting the Russians, helping to combat the American terrorists that they imported and have been supplying with weapons, training, and so forth ever since.
Very well. Thank you very much for that. That was Michael Springman, author and former diplomat there from Washington, D.C., and also James Dutras. Thank you, former U.S. Senate Foreign Policy Analyst, also from Washington, D.C. And that does it for this edition of The Debate. For Mika Vitahweis, goodbye until next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Donald Trump and Joe Biden offered sharply contrasting reactions on Monday to news of a coronavirus vaccine that proved nearly 95% effective in trials. In a press conference, the president-elect Joe Biden called the vaccine really encouraging but warned more people may die unless the Trump administration starts cooperating with the incoming Democratic administration. We're going into a very dark winter. Things are going to get much tougher before they get easier, he said. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalists David Smith and Dominic Rush, writing for The Guardian. The piece is titled, Biden Warns More People May Die Unless Trump Starts Cooperating. Stay with us for more of David Smith and Dominic Rush's article. Trump and Joe Biden offered sharply contrasting reactions on Monday, 16th of November, to news of a coronavirus vaccine that proved nearly 95% effective in trials. In a press conference, the president-elect Joe Biden called the vaccine news really encouraging, but warned more people may die unless the Trump administration starts cooperating with the incoming Democratic administration. We're going into a very dark winter. Things are going to get much tougher before they get easier, he said. Rather than working to combat the coronavirus, which is spreading faster than ever and on average killing more than 1,000 Americans a day, Donald Trump has stayed focused on unsubstantiated claims that the presidential election was stolen. Pharmaceutical giant Moderna said on Monday its experimental vaccine was 94.5% effective, based on the interim data from a late-stage clinical trial. Another vaccine just announced, Donald Trump tweeted, seeking to claim credit, this time by Moderna, 95% effective. For those great historians, please remember that these great discoveries, which will end the China plague, all took place on my watch. Critics say Donald Trump has all but surrendered to the pandemic, which has killed more than 244,000 Americans and is averaging more than 100,000 cases per day. Michael Osterholm, an advisor to Joe Biden, told NBC on Sunday, "We are in a very dangerous period, the most dangerous public health period since 1918. President Trump has not attended a task force meeting in at least 5 months, according to public health expert Dr. Anthony Fauci, speaking on Sunday, 15th of November. Dr. Fauci added, "He seems to have bet everything on a vaccine. Trump appeared consumed instead by the election and now by denying its outcome." Joe Biden beat Donald Trump by the same 306-232 margin in the Electoral College that Trump described as a landslide when he won in 2016. The Democrat is also ahead in the popular vote by 5.5 million votes, or 3.6% of all ballots cast, with ballots still being counted. The Trump administration has not recognized Biden as president-elect, preventing his team from gaining access to government office space and government funding. Democrats and some Republicans have warned that refusal to give Joe Biden access to intelligence poses a risk to national security and hampers the battle against the coronavirus, including vaccine distribution planning. Joe Biden said the delay was more embarrassing than debilitating, and that he was continuing to put in place his team and plans to deal with the pandemic and its economic fallout. The pandemic is the most pressing crisis facing the incoming president. Ron Klein, who will be White House Chief of Staff, said Biden advisors would meet Pfizer and other drug makers this week. White House officials and Republicans in Congress are outnumbered by world leaders in acknowledging Joe Biden's win. On Monday, 16th of November, Robert O'Brien, Trump's national security advisor, noted that a transition would only take place if the current lawsuits don't work out for the president. But speaking at the Global Security Forum, O'Brien acknowledged, if there is a new administration, they deserve some time to come in and implement their policies. We may have policy disagreements, but look, if the Biden-Harris ticket is determined to be the winner, and obviously things look that way now, we'll have a very professional transition from the National Security Council. There is no question about it. The president appeared on Sunday to publicly acknowledge that Biden had won the election, but then backtracked and reiterated his false claim the vote was rigged. Donald Trump, who has put Rudy Giuliani, the former New York mayor, in charge of his legal offensive, tweeted on Sunday that he would soon file big cases challenging election results. However, his campaign has already lost numerous court battles and dropped a major part of a lawsuit seeking to prevent Pennsylvania from certifying its results, narrowing the case to a small number of ballots. Joe Biden won the state by more than 68,000 votes. On Monday, Donald Trump tweeted, "The radical left Democrats, working with their partner, the fake news media, are trying to steal this election. We won't let them." In a statement issued last week by the lead U.S. cybersecurity agency, federal election security officials dismissed such unfounded claims and expressed utmost confidence in the integrity of the elections. Officials from both political parties have said there is no evidence of major irregularities. Joe Biden has called Donald Trump's refusal to concede an embarrassment and is pressing ahead with the transition. On Monday, 16th of November, he and running mate Kamala Harris spoke about the economic recovery and building back better in the long term, in their first speech addressing the economic situation since their victory. Biden outlined a $7.3 trillion plan ahead of the election that, among other goals, would bolster crumbling infrastructure, build a clean energy economy, and support domestic manufacturing with cash for research and development. His first aim is to pass a new stimulus plan, but it is unclear how likely he is to pass any deal while Republicans control the Senate, which will hinge on runoff elections in Georgia in January. Talks about a new stimulus package have been deadlocked for months. The economic situation has improved but remains at a knife edge. Unemployment has dropped dramatically since a high of 14.7% in April, but worrying signs remain. By October, the unemployment rate had fallen to 6.9%, but the number of long-term unemployed, those who seek a job for 27 weeks or more, increased by 1.2 million to 3.6 million. Almost a third of the total number of people out of work are now long-term unemployed, Black and Latino Americans suffering far higher rates of unemployment than their white neighbors. Jobs growth has continued to slow, and each week people are filing unemployment claims at a rate still more than three times as high as before the pandemic. Elise Gould, senior economist at the Economics Policy Institute, said, "If this drags on and the pace of jobs growth continues to slow down, it will take years before we get back to pre-pandemic economy. Americans cannot afford the political games that are being played."
Good morning! morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.